Hey, Mark here with an introduction to the exclusive interview we have with Kicker Lee. Now, this one was a long one, so you can enjoy it in a couple of different ways. You can see the whole episode with images on YouTube. You can hear the whole episode on our full-length podcast, or you can listen to it cut into two parts, which is what this is. Part one, which will follow, is the introduction to Kicker Lee. It's the origins of his name, the accident that he had that reinvented his artistic career, a little about his time in France, the him discovering the artist Monet and that leading to his book Musné. And then he goes on to talk about his Western book, Purdy. In part two, we get all into the detail of him rediscovering G.I. Joe and all of his G.I. Joe work. So if you want the shortened version, getting to the meat of G.I. Joe, that's the episode to go with. But for the patient of you who wants to find out a little bit more about Kicker Lee, listen to the whole thing, and I'm sure you will reap the benefits and enjoy it all. Catch you other side of the jingle.
Live from the Talking Joe Studios, it's Talking Joe.
Talking Joe is on the air.
Hey, it's me, Mark, and welcome to Talking Joe, the comics podcast for G.I. Joe. Today we are speaking to special guest Kicker Lee, Yilkic. I'll double check the pronunciation of the surname there, but Kicker Lee may be famous to many of you already. He's based in Minnesota and has been publishing and making art professionally for over 20 years, and most famously for this community here, lots of G.I. Joe art. He's had published work that includes Western, Purdy, action, science fiction, children's books, and being published globally. He is also got an interesting side career all about being an official pro sports artist. So we'll talk to that subject a little as well. But I will not be doing it alone, because I am joined, as always, by my co-host who hides underneath his desk when we're not speaking. It is Tim Finn.
Hides, lives. Hello, Mark. Hello, listeners. Hello, viewers. Let's get to our guest.
Here he is. Can you kick it? Can you Kicker Lee it? Yes, you can. It's Kicker Lee. Here we go.
Hey, everybody.
Welcome to Talking Joe.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, nice to see you, Mark. Nice to see you, Tim.
First up, do you want to correct me on my pronunciation?
Yeah, to clear that up, that all came about, so it's just Kicker Lee. When I joined Facebook, they wouldn't let me have one name, so they said, you know, I had to have a last name, so I just I just flipped it around. And I thought at that time, which was kind of funny, I was like, what I thought of first was Tomax and Zaymot, you know? I was like, I'll Tomax and Zaymot it, you know? I'll flip it around. And so that, to me, I just like, I didn't ever think about it. And then everyone who I meet is always trying to yickle, and I'm like, I don't know how to say it either. I'm just, you know, I never think about it. But yeah, it's just Kicker Lee. It should be my real last name. I was in a car accident about 10 years ago now. And I had, after going through rehab and everything, and long story short, once I started making art again, I went to go sign my name, and I was like, I'm going to take back my real family last name. So I just put it, I was like, I'll work underneath this if I show this work to anybody. And so I just started signing Kicker Lee. And so then a publisher, I was in Paris for 4 or 5 years, France, and I was going out to eat with publishers, and I kind of got wooed back into making comic books, because I was painting, and I was like, I'm going to be a painter. but I didn't really know how to go about it because it's a completely different world. It's similar, but it's different because of the whole system of having galleries and shows and displaying your paintings and having agents and dealing with the, you know, the museums and stuff like that. But so I was like, I'll just do one. I had a couple good ideas and I just went with that. And then I started making comics, but I was like, I told the publishers, I'm like, I'm working underneath this name now. So my original goal was just to work underneath that name. And I told them, I was like, I don't really want anyone knowing who I am. I don't care about any of that stuff anymore. I just want to do the work and let it stand on its own. So probably for like three or four years, people didn't know who I was. So there's, especially in France or in the French speaking world of comic books, they were all wondering who I was. So, and then I had to start doing signings and everything. And that's where it slowly started coming out. Because a lot of the French artists over there already knew who I was. And they're like, wait, what? What is going on? You know, so. Yeah, that's kind of how it came about.
Is there an evil twin somewhere nearby? And when you see art that causes you distress, this evil twin also feels bad?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I have to decipher evil twin. So like my old self of like the name, like, you know, that I worked under before, was, you know, name I still go by in private life, I guess, in my civilian life, Sam Heady. So, yeah, it's like people found that out. It just, you know, at the time it was, you know, it wasn't trying to, you know, it caused a stir, I guess, when, you know, when I did that and I left my old life. And, you know, I kind of, you know, it's not until I have to do these kind of interviews that I have to kind of go through and think about what it was. But it just, at the time I was injured and, you know, dealing with post-traumatic stress and everything. And I didn't realize that it was post-traumatic stress until I went through physical rehab and everything. And they were wanting me to do like more of a mental side of it, like a group therapy type stuff. And I was like, I don't want to do that. And they're like, well, what else are you going to do? Because I'd go to therapy and then come home and go to bed and lay down in my bed. And kind of, I was depressed and in a bad place. And so I was going, the first class of that was just like, hey, if you're going through these steps, these five or six steps, this is post-traumatic stress. And I was like, wait, what? I was like, I only thought soldiers, you know, got that, you know, from war. But they're like, no, it's everyone gets it from trauma and everything. So, it, you know, it just something that the therapist said in there was, you know, at some point, because, you know, everybody, because I went through like a physical transformation and everything. It's like I lost a ton of weight. I looked like a skeleton. You know, my skin was gray. You know, it was just I looked horrible. And people kept asking, like, if I went out to anywhere, what happened? And I'm like, oh, I don't want to keep telling people this. You know, I was still injured and everything. And so the group therapist was like, you know, you just have to, like, leave this old part behind, because I couldn't make art. Every single time I was coming around my art or when I went into my studio and stuff, I felt like passing out or blacking out. And they're like, yeah, it's part of the post-traumatic stress. So you have to do something in order to jumpstart your system again. And, you know, this was like almost a year. And, you know, everything that I've built myself to be and the business that I created and, you know, I had movie options, I had, you know, major book deal, all, you know, self-publishing, everything was built on this. And it was like for a year, I couldn't do it. And it just was like, I didn't think I'd ever be able to do it again, because where I was injured in my back from the car accident, I was injured in two spots. One, the top part went down my right arm, which was my drawing arm. And if I put any kind of pressure on my leaning, if you lean your arm down and draw with your wrist, which I did, it would just cause a lot of pain and I couldn't draw. So I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. So after rehab, they said, you need to do something different. And so I went to Paris. My wife's aunt is French. So I went to go stay with her and her daughter who lived over there. And I went back and forth multiple times, you know, and then I started getting work and everything. So I was going there for work then. But it took a few trips. Like the first trip that I went, I think I started trying to draw towards the end of the trip, which I was there for a few months. And when I came home, that I think I start, you know, I can't remember. Like, again, it's kind of like a weird blur because when I say it's been 10 years, it's like it feels kind of like yesterday, but a lot of it is, you know, very time is mashed together in a weird way. So it's not until I see the books that I've done since that I can kind of remember the time and where I was, because, you know, comics take a long time to work on, and you know, and just having those successful accomplishments of getting the book done, I remember those times in a sense. So otherwise it's a big blur.
Yeah, Tim thinks of time in blocks of about 24 years between starting a book.
Yeah. No, and I was, you know, the first two books, so I did a book called Musnay, which was The Mouse of Monet. It was about a little mouse that stumbled upon Monet's garden in France. He was like a little vagabond mouse. Because I was studying all these painters, and again, I was painting, but I was in the museums all the time and doing studies of paintings and trying to figure out how these people work, because since I was injured when I went to Paris for the first time, I was just like, okay, I felt like the way that I went about my art career prior, it was always in the back of my head of like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I would see all these French impressionist painters or, you know, classic painters that we all know, and I just kind of feel like, oh man, I don't know anything. These guys, you can tell, like, they know anatomy very well, they know how to sculpt, they know how to paint, and once you kind of get going, or once I kind of started getting going and getting known before, it kind of felt weird to stop, you know. I you know, it's just like I have jobs coming in. I have books that I need to finish. So there's really no time to stop and be like, I'm going to learn how to do this properly. So when I was in, after I went to Paris from the accident, I was like, I'm not going to try and relearn how to draw or do things the way that I did before. This is my chance to really wipe the slate clean and just treat. I literally was like, okay, I don't know anything. This is how I'm going to approach everything, is I don't know anything, and I'm going to really try and learn how to do this. I don't know if it's the right way, but kind of the way I thought before is just like, I'm going to learn how to classically make art by studying these masters. And I really started seeing right away, like, because you go into museums and you'd have Rembrandt, you know, Rembrandt would kind of be in his own section of the pre impressionists and stuff like that. But once you kind of got into more of the impressionist section, you know, you'd have Degas next to Renoir, next to Manet, next to Monet. You know, and I was all confused because I'm like, I know kind of who these guys are, but I really, they all have similar names and they all have similar styles in a weird way. But I was like, they all, because of how they kind of jumbled all these paintings around, wasn't like Monet had a section, and then Renoir had a section, and still they just kind of intermingle them. And I started seeing right away, like, these guys all know the same thing. And it's like, this has to have been taught. So I started kind of really going down the rabbit hole of reading what I could. And certain museums would have sketchbooks out every once in a while under glass. And I would get so frustrated because I'm like, ah, can you just turn the page? Like, there has to be like a button here that would turn the page that you don't turn the book. But, you know, collecting books there with sketches, you know, artist sketches and, you know, notes and everything, I started kind of piecing it together. But the first time that I came home, you know, I was here for a few months, then I went back. And, you know, I was painting when I got back home then. And then when I went back the next time, that's when I really started painting. Yeah, it's just, you know, that seeing little things of how they all worked. And I was kind of trying to decode their knowledge. And Rembrandt, going to Rembrandt then and finding out about him, it's like they, if you became like a study of his, or like a, you're kind of almost like a studio slave in a weird way, of like, you'd start you off with the broom and you'd broom for 3 or 4 years and you wouldn't touch anything. And then you'd, if you stuck around, right? If you stuck around, then he'd have you building his canvases or priming his canvases, or then mixing his paints, because, you know, they didn't come in tubes. You'd have to get oil, pour it with the pigment and mix it together. And every morning he would get there, some kid, I'd imagine, would be there a couple hours earlier mixing his paints. So by the time Rembrandt would come to the studio, his paints would be ready and fresh, you know. But it's kind of like Karate Kid, the wax on, wax off, and all that stuff is like, when are you going to teach me karate? It's like weirdly enough, he's probably teaching you how to paint. And if you're in that studio that long watching him work, you're going to be, in, you know, brooming and watching, right? And I think you'd probably pick up a lot of information just before you even start painting. So all this knowledge kind of fed into the Musnay book then. And when I was, like I said, I was going out with a few publishers, I mean, the big publishers in Paris. And I pitched them a few ideas and it got shot down. They're like, nah. I pitched them a really cool sci-fi comic, which I wrote, you know, I wrote a full script on and sent it in, and the editor liked it, but the publisher said no, or the main company. And so they're like, maybe try like a kids series. And so I pitched them this mouse thing, because my wife's aunt, she was off of work, and she was like, we should go, because I'd come home from the museums and just be like, Monet is my favorite. You know, I don't know what it is about his work, but it's really cool. And she's like, well, you know, he's got his house and garden not too far. It's like a half hour drive, 40 minute drive to his house. So we went and I was blown away. I didn't want to go. I was like, a garden? Nah. You know, I've seen enough gardens. But then I was like, what am I thinking? No, I want to go.
You're going to see the light that he saw.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see exactly. The water that he saw on the leaves.
Yeah. But when you're in Paris, I don't know. It just, I kind of adopted the mentality of the George Costanza mentality, where I was like, I'm going to do the opposite of everything I ever thought before. Cause I've been, you know, wrong about certain things. And like I said, I'm rebuilding my life in a way. I'm just going to rebuild my whole mind. And so I'm like, I'm going to do the opposite of everything I've ever thought and did before. And so I was like, no, I'm going to go to this garden. And it was amazing. It's just, I spent so much time just in the garden portion. And they, you know, then you can walk through his house and everything. And they, he has like a museum, and not connected to the house property. It's kind of more in the back inside this village, but he has this, his Monet's collection of the paintings that he has from friends and, you know, things he probably traded paintings for, or, you know, other artists gave him. So we went to that, but before we went to that, we got something to eat, and a little mouse got trapped, was in the area where we're eating outside, and people were eking and kind of like, ah, it's a mouse, you know? And so I was just teasing my wife's aunt of like, don't worry, because I could see she was kind of like, a mouse and we're going to eat, you know, kind of deal. So I was like, oh, don't worry, it's just Monet's mouse, and he lives in his beard and he learns how to paint, you know. And and she was laughing the whole time, and I was thinking, this is kind of a good idea. So I kind of stashed away in the back of my head. And so when they asked me for like a children's idea, I just started kind of, well, this mouse that stumbles upon Monet's garden, and they're like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I just kept saying it, and they're like, do you have any drawings? I'm like, yeah, no, I'll send you something tomorrow. And I was up all night, you know, trying to draw the stuff, you know, because I was still injured. So I started using my left hand a lot. And I did the first book and the part of the second with mainly my left hand.
For our listeners, our viewers, there are four books.
Yeah, there's four. Yeah. And it's the first book is spring, then the second book is summer, then it's fall and winter. So it's the season of the garden. Because hanging around there then, because the first time I went, I didn't take any photos, nothing. I just went to just go and look. And then I was like, shoot, I should have took pictures. So I went back there, but it was winter at that time. And I had to take photos over the fence because the garden was closed. It's closed during the winter. Just the gardeners work there. They strip the whole thing dry. There's nothing left over. They just take up every plant. It's pretty cool how it looks. So I was taking photos in the winter that I had to use for spring for this book. And then after the first book came out, I was like, I want this book in their bookshop, which it's the bookshop is like his third studio. So he has three studios. The first one he never worked in. It was just more for when he'd have famous guests like opera singers or, you know, whoever would come over and want to buy a painting. He would have like this fake studio in a sense set up, with his paintings hanging on the wall and like an easel or something to make it look like he worked in there. But the first time I went in there, I was like, he didn't work in here. And my step aunt was like, how do you know that? And I was like, I can just tell, like the light is the same as my studio. There's no north light. And all these artists, everything that I've read is they all worked under north light because it's more consistent. It's like a reflected light that's a consistent ambient light all day. And where my studio that I'm in right now is, you know, east, south, and west light, and the sun travels, so it's different light all day long. I can draw on this light, but painting is not like, to do a painting, you only have, you know, the sun changes so much that you have a different, the painting will look completely different all day long. The colors will. So north light is what they painted under. So after the first book came out, I reached out to the Monet Foundation and asked if I could come take proper pictures of the home. And they were like, yeah, they already knew who I was. And they invited me and they took me out to eat. You know, like a three-star, the chef, they introduced, you know, the chef came out and introduced himself to me. And I was just like treated very well. And I was like, this is really cool. And I kind of started adopting the idea of like, okay, I'm on sacred ground here. Like, don't do anything stupid, you know, like treat this like really sacredly, I guess, you know, like walking on eggshells, any kind of terminology like that. It was just like, just, you know, don't be as respectful as possible. It just for the lineage of not going in there and being like trying to sell or, you know, it's just, again, I've read so much about these guys and I knew so much about Monet that, you know, cause at first pre-accident, I thought like probably how a lot of people think is Monet, oh, happy guy painting these beautiful colors, the flowers, all this. And no, he was a wreck. His mom died when he was really young. Then the love of his life, his wife, his first wife. I don't know if he got, I can't remember. I think he got married again. I don't think he did though. I can't remember now. But his first wife died and he was just depressed. He was laying in bed. If it rained, they said, like all the people that I talked to there, because the gardeners were like a lineage of family gardeners. So I learned really quick, ask the gardeners because they would know the best stories because the generation before them told them about them, you know, about Monet. So they told me the best stories. And they would say, like, whenever it would rain, Monet would be in his bed and wouldn't want to get up, and he would throw tantrums, and, you know, they kind of had to get him out of bed to eat and move around and stuff. So I thought that was pretty fun because he wanted to be outside painting. So the rain was spoiling his day. And then they said also, like, he considered himself a gardener first and a painter second. And that really blew me, like what Tim's head was like, huh? Like, is, yeah, I was like, wait, what? No, he's a painter. I was like, no. And then after spending like a lot of time in the gardens, I understood what it meant. Is he didn't paint for 3 years when he started making, or when he bought that property and he started planting these plants, because he was figuring out how to be a gardener and make these flowers, these different combinations of flowers grow, so that there was color theory within his garden. And I was just like, it gets really deep, because there's the gardeners there still have like a, I don't know, 15 to 20 year plan before his blueprints are fulfilled. So they're still trying to make it the way he wanted it, because he left detailed instructions before he died. So spending enough time there, I saw, like, he saw the life and death cycle of these plants three times before he started painting them. And so he really understood this place before he started painting. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna kind of, how do I put this in the story? And that's kind of where I came up with the four books of the seasons of the garden. You know, there's life and death. And at that time too, my dad was dying. So it kind of had this weird backstory. So by the time you get warning, by the time you get to the fourth book, it's kind of sad since it's a winter season. But there's beauty in that too. It's like, because there's something seeing the garden going from this full spring, summer, fall. Each season he had different flowers would come up and bloom, and you'd get different color theories. And then winter, everything's gutted. It's all dirt and, you know, a little bit of snow. There's not so too much snow there, but it's cold, rainy mainly. And so you have that season, and it's cool. I haven't thought about it for a while, because I haven't, you know, I worked on that first series and got it done and moved on to the next one. So
Tim, as a retailer, you stock this book, don't you? How did you discover it? You know, it's French published. It's not necessarily the US regular mainstream comics?
Good question. So there's a small publisher in the States, Uncivilized Books, and I'm on an emailing list from an independent sales agent in New York who represents a lot of small publishers to comic book stores that either aren't carried through Diamond or are, but in small quantities. And when those books sell out, Diamond doesn't rush to restock them. And I get three emails a day from this independent sales agent in New York. And a lot of it is like catalog announcements and press releases and pictures of covers and descriptions and price and page number and dates. And I'm sort of always looking for something that's a good fit for my store. And there's a small strata of independent publisher in America, that's sold in America, like Avery Hill, they're British, Uncivilized Books. If any of you are Craig Thompson fans from Blankets or Habibi, Uncivilized Books has been publishing his most recent work, which is called Ginseng Roots. And like Highwater Books, which is long out of business. But these are publishers that either make, it's like they're not doing like big genre stuff that becomes movies, like superhero stuff or sci-fi stuff. These publishers are doing stuff that's more artsy, more indie, to use an imprecise word. So we were already carrying one or two things from Uncivilized Books. And Uncivilized has a children's imprint called ODOD, which is spelled O-D-O-D. And if you're looking at a cover to Muse, you see like four little dots on the bottom of the cover. That's what that is. That's that word. Mm-hmm. Completely independent of Kikkoli making G.I. Joe artwork, I think 8 years ago, we were carrying the first Muse book.
Yeah, it came out simultaneously because we had them print the English in French or in France with the French printers.
Oh, is it?
So it had the same printed quality. It's the same book. It's just a different black plate that printed the lettering in English. So it's the same exact same book as the French book, printed at the same exact time.
Were you published through Uncivilized because Uncivilized is based in Minnesota?
Minneapolis. I knew Tom. Yeah, I knew okay. Tom K. Yeah. So, and after the act, you know, when I think it was before I went to Paris, I can't remember. It must've been the second time. And I met with him and I kind of told him, hey, you know, because I meeting with French publishers and stuff like that kind of made me be like, I might do comics. So I wanted to keep my English rights because the French publishers, for the most part, they want to, you know, take all the, you know, everything. So I kind of held on to English rights because, you know, I was like, well, I already have a publisher here. So. And now it's just like self-published my own stuff. So, but at the time I was like, I don't want to have to deal with all this stuff. I can barely make art. So I didn't want to have to worry about the publishing end of things. So,
we have our copies of Muse, right next to Carl Barks, Uncle Scrooge, and Donald Duck, and some of the, Disney Afternoon reprints that Fantagraphic has been doing, and some of the children's books that that No Brow does through its Flying Eye imprint.
Yeah.
So, you know, for American fans, Muse, these are like European bande dessinée style albums.
Yep.
It's like taller, they're skinny, they're hardcover. These are not, quote, floppies. Like there is no like trade paperback collection. It's four skinny hardcovers, and you'd think, just looking, you'd think that it's a children's book like Dr. Seuss, as opposed to comics. And then you open it up and they're word balloons.
Again, it's like, you know, with spending enough time and learning about all these painters and everything, it was like, how do I don't want to be giving like a history lesson of all these French artists or painters, but I kind of saw it being like, it's going on in the background. The history is going on, and if I can kind of keep that in the background, but me going through my accident and all the stuff that I was dealing with, post-traumatic stress, depression, all this, and then finding out about Monet and what he was going through, I felt like this kinship with him, you know? And so I kind of wanted to build, I was like, we're, this mouse in a sense is me, you know? But he's going to have like this, the same kind of, so I didn't need to make the book about Monet as much as it was about Monet. It was about this mouse, which it, again, it's like the every person. 'Cause I was, you know, and then the next series that I want to do is him in Paris. And I think I'd focus on more like Degas and Rodin, who's a sculptor, because when I was then being paid by the publisher to come and do signings and spend time there, you know, working on the book and everything, I stayed near Rodin's house, and it was similar. I was there all the time because it was just right down the street. So I'd go in, and he had this huge garden too. And so I'm just like, you know, all these artists with their gardens. And I was like, well, if Monet ever came to Paris and studied there, which the second series would take place there, he would be at Rodin. So I'd imagine he'd probably start sculpting then because of all the things and that are there. And then Degas would, you know, I think Degas is, you know, I love Monet, but Degas to me is probably the most well-rounded of all those artists. Like, he could do everything. He could use any kind of medium. He was constantly challenging himself to learn more and more. He didn't settle. You know, he has a famous quote where somebody asked him, "What's your style?" And he said, I'll find my style when I'm dead." You know, because he's pretty much saying, like, you know, after I stop working, you can judge my body of work, and that's what my style will be. But in his head, he had no style. He was just learning and trying to implement. You know, he used oils, then used, you know, engravings, ink, pastels. He was sculpting all the time. He was doing everything. So I'd like to kind of take all the knowledge that I know about him and put him somehow in the book, the same kind of way. So
is this the segue to G.I. Joe? Because I look at your G.I. Joe paintings and I think that looks like gouache. So Mark.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. Yeah. That
was going to be the question. What's this, talking about materials, what's the segue to gouache and the work that we know from seeing your G.I. Joe work?
When I was working on Monet, I did the painted all the covers are fully painted, and the first cover is they're all kind of like a riff on one of Monet's paintings, but I just put the mouse in the painting somehow. But I wanted to recreate them like I was doing studies and stuff. And when you use oil, it's reflective because of how it dries. And so it's hard to scan in oil painting. So that first cover, I knew somewhat about gouache, but I knew it dried flat, like a matte, so it wouldn't be glossy and you could scan it in. And so, but when I used it, I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing. And it's such a hard medium to use. It never really dries. So it dries, but you can reactivate it with water. So if you don't know what you're doing when you're painting on it, because you paint it, and as soon as you get done painting, you know, like 20 seconds later, it's dry, unless you're keeping it wet somehow. So you have to learn how to paint so you don't reactivate the paint underneath it. And so I stopped using it after that first cover because it just drove me nuts. And then I kind of started figuring out going to like life drawing, because I was doing oil paintings in life drawing class. You know, you go and study a nude for you know, and they stand there for 5 minutes and then change the pose. And I was oil painting and doing sketches and stuff. And everybody thought I was crazy because they're like, what are you doing with oil paints in here? Normally it's charcoal. And I'm like, I want to get good. You know, I want to get fast and good. You don't have time. You don't have time. The light changes, people move, whatever. So it's just, and I figured out by painting on like a untreated board, the oil would soak into the board and it would dry flat. And I was like, oh, wait a minute. I discovered something here. And so I was able to then for book 2, 3, and 4 of Musnay, I was able to oil paint, but do it on this board and it would absorb the oils and the pigment would be left over and it would dry flat. So I was able to scan that in and use it.
You're talking about the covers.
Yeah, for the covers.
The interiors are...
They're computer. They're kind of a combination of a wash, like a wash of color to create shadows. And then I did simple computer flats for that. Because comic books are really hard. If you're going to paint a whole book, like you better make sure there's no corrections, you know, so you'd have to do like a lot of work up front to make sure that the publisher has approved everything before you go into the painting stage, because if there are a few corrections and stuff like that, I didn't want to take that much time. And I, you know, comic books, even for me being an American, I'm used to the system of people wanting it every month, you know, or at least every couple months. Where in France, it's you just put out one 48-page book a year, pretty much, unless you work for different publishers. And for that part, most of those guys are doing it because they're getting advances from different publishers. So it's allowing them to live, you know, if you're getting $20,000 here, $20,000, you know, whatever the advance is, you're working on multiple books at the same time, but they're from different publishers. So... because the publisher's not going to really commit to doing a lot of volumes because they're already, you know, putting out a lot of volumes of everyone's work. So they want to kind of just focus on one book, maybe two books a year maximum from an artist. But with Musnay, I did those four books in about a year. And so it's just kind of like, doing computer colors was just easy because the first book's always the hardest because you don't know what the color palette is going to be really of what, you know, day and night cycles and, you know, what everyone is. So you're able, if I was to paint it, I'd really have to do studies of making sure everything is its color and you're locked into that. Where the computer colors, by the end of the book, I'd go back through and make a final pass and just be like, ah, oh, this is wrong. And you just kind of click and change it. And it's so much easier to do. But I wanted to paint it, right? So if I did a second Musnay series, knowing what I know now, I'd probably do a painted inside because I'm just comfortable with doing it.
Okay. Since people watching this, listening to this, may go to a comic book store and you have a graphic novel published through Image, which every comic book store can get.
Yep.
I know you are not the world's most developed capitalist.
Yeah.
Can you, like, what's the one sentence or one paragraph pitch? Like, sell our audience on Purdy. How can you get people into their store to buy or special order Purdy?
So Purdy, there's two volumes. There's one and two, and it's like act one of the story. It's about a woman that just gets out of prison. Out of Yuma prison in Yuma, Arizona. It would be Yuma territory during that time. It was the prison that they would send the worst people to. And it's the only one that housed women as well. And when I developed this story, you know, I had my ideas of who the character was, but when I went to go to Yuma, because I learned from like what I've been saying with Monet and everything, I'd like to go to the location to see what it looks like, what it smells like, what the atmosphere is like, all that, do some studies. And then they have this fragment of the prison still remaining. The movie 310 to Yuma, that's what it's referring to, is this train that's coming at 310 is going to Yuma prison. But in the movie, it never got there. I don't think any movie has ever featured this prison before or story. I'm sure there's like books and stories on it. So I went to this prison and the what's remaining, and it's kind of like this little museum. And they had all these women, and they were, you start reading like all these biographies of these women, and it's like, oh, this is horrible. The person that I made was fictitious, but I was just wanting to do at the time, I think this was 2015, 2015, 2016 that I developed the story. I wanted to, you know, do a Western, but, you know, I was like, well, no one's ever, you know, used women a certain way. There's been women in Westerns and stuff, but for the most part, they're kind of like babes and, you know, but I, you know, having been injured and not up to full speed, I was kind of thinking like, wonder what it would be like for somebody to have been in prison then come out and be the same way. Like she was a crook and a robber and a thief, not a good person. And she was very, you know, it's Purdy. Purdy is Western talk for pretty, right? And she spent the majority of her years in prison where she lost her beauty, the one thing that would help her be bad. And so I was like, well, I could kind of identify to the character of like, well, I'm kind of coming out and I'm not fully as quick as I used to be and stuff. So I kind of started playing around with this woman character. And so it's a story about this woman who gets out of prison. Sorry, it's you're saying, oh, I gotta make a quick pitch. And I start making this long pitch. But here's the quick pitch. It's about a woman.
This elevator, this elevator speech is a tall building. Tall building.
Yeah, exactly. But she gets out of prison and she's trying to get back into form of what's making her bad. But I part of me too is like trying to think like, I don't know, do I spoil it, you know, because it's kind of like it's a slow burn kind of comic. And
no,
the big hook is like is the big hook.
Don't spoil it.
Yeah, so I don't know. And spending a lot of time in France, you know, I was around, you know, women who, you know, because again, it's different there than it is here in the United States, and like how sexuality, you know, like what's being portrayed of like within like going out to like a mall or, you know, whatever. It's just it's different here in America. How it's advertised of things, and being around the culture there in Paris is just like, okay. So it made me start thinking. And I was reading like this documentary too on Payne, the painter, Edgar Payne, I think his name is. He's a landscape artist. I think it was him. I don't remember now. Sorry. Bad, worst pitch ever. But I was reading this one painter, and his dad was a bad gambler, and they had to get up in the middle of the night. He remembered a few times of just like leaving everything behind. Like they had to go because the people that he owed money to were going to find him and kill him. So they had to up and leave. So this was his childhood. He remembered like leaving this. And so this was in the back of my head. And I went to this publisher and they're like, hey, we want you to do like an American comic for us. Like, you know, they don't have Americans over there making comics, or they didn't when I was there. So they were like, it would be very interesting to have an American make an American comic for the French market. And I said, well, and my brain started reeling, and I was like, started coming up with this idea of Purdy on the fly. And I said, well, it doesn't get any more American than a Western. And they were like, yeah, what else you got? And I'm like, well, and then I remembered reading about this artist's father who was a bad gambler. And I said, well, there's this woman. And then I started piecing all this stuff together. And they were like, oh, that's great. This sounds great. And I was like, okay. And it was like Musnay, where I said, like, they were like, do you have any drawings or anything? I'm like, yeah, I can get them to you tomorrow, you know? And then I went back And I just started drawing all this stuff, and I presented it to him. And so, yeah. And then, you know, all the stuff like going to Yuma and whatever is more the stuff that kind of comes right before making the actual book. The coolest thing about Yuma, Arizona, the museum or the jail that I went to, is they had this big diorama of the way it used to look. So I was able to take like photos of what this place looked like and just, you know, use it as reference. So that was pretty cool. And I was going to have like for the book launch, because Image Comics is the publisher for that. But I was going to have like a book launch at this place, and it kind of fizzled out at the end because, again, I always does this, but somebody, one of the board members or someone was like, wait a minute, we could make money off of this. And I'm like, I'm out. I'm like, I wanted to bring people to this place and have it be this cool party, like to launch this book thing and have people come and see Yuma and see this prison and experience it. Cause I went there, I was doing like a photo shoot there. I had a friend come and photo shoot me, and I wanted me to be inside the prison because they still have like all these old prison stuff, you know, like cells and stuff. And I said, do you guys have like a old prison uniform? And they're like, I think we do. And so they brought one out, and it's like a potato sack, you know, like a burlap. And I'm like, this is what they wore? And they're like, yeah. And I put it on, and it, you know, it's itchy and it's heavy and it's like woven and it's just like prickling into you and stuff. And then it's so hot there. My friend who was taking photos, he goes, oh, it was so hot. But he goes, every single time I thought it was hot, I looked at you and I was like, no, I'm okay. Cause I was in the sun and I was in the prison cell and I was just dripping. I was, you know, I was reading Purdy, you know, in a sense with the photo. It was me in the prison suit. I thought those things turned out, it looked pretty fun. But
will there, is there talk with Image to release these two books as soft covers?
Yeah, you know, the problem is it didn't sell, you know?
Ah, right. So the answer is no.
Yeah. You know, the hard part with working with publishers is, you know, it's like I only have so much time and energy to promote this stuff, you know? And, you know, it's there, but at a certain point after the initial launch, it's like, you know, if they're not talking about it, nobody knows it exists. So with me, it's like, you know, it's like I did my part, if it doesn't sell, then, you know, how do I make more people buy it? I don't know. That's kind of why I went back to self-publishing, because it's just like, if I have to do all that, I'd rather just sell. And I know exactly who's buying the books. You know, I know who, you know, I'm shipping it to them. If stores buy it, like Tiempos Finales right now, I'm just kind of doing it as I'm working on it. And if you want to buy a single issue, it's expensive, right, for a comic, but it's not going to be for sale as soon as it comes to the collection. So if you want to buy like these little vignettes of what this story is as I'm working on it, then you can buy it. But it's like I'm working on it right now. And it takes a lot of time and effort to do everything, lettering, writing, coloring, the printing, the shipping, everything. So
it's almost like you're saying that someone should be compensated for their labor. Labors.
No, I'm not saying you know, again, it's like I'm talking like as, you know, as I'm talking, I'm trying to think of, you know, how to say this. It's not for sale. It's not saying like Image didn't do their job, but it's also, it's a company, right? It's the French company, same thing. It's like they put out a product, the next week they have new product, you know, they have to, and they can't sit there and talk about one thing over the other because they're only going to sell a certain amount. And it's hard because it's like, I, you know, not working with publishers before and then working with publishers, it's the same thing of like, I don't know how this works. I'm going to kind of sit back and see what happens and then make my decision of how I want to go about doing this, you know? And I think what I found is I was right. Me laying in bed for 4 months, 3 months, thinking about was I right or not of going with publishers, I came to the conclusion, no, I was right. I want to do this by myself. I like having this connection with the people. I like having the connection because, again, it takes forever to do this stuff. And then you put it out and you don't, I don't know who bought Purdy. I don't know who bought Musnay for the most part. There's some people, right? When you go to a convention and they come up and they say hi to you, whatever. But I know the people that are buying Tiempos Finales or any independent stuff that I'm doing. It's like, it's the same people. And they're all supporting me because they like my work. So, and like I said before, it's like, I'm not in this to, I'm not trying to make record sales of stuff. I just need to make enough sales to be able to keep doing what I'm doing. And if I can do that, then that's what I'll do because I can do whatever I want and how I want to do it. Because it's hard work, but if it's fun, it makes it a lot better.
Warning team, as the sands of time descend, we will leave Kickley there. And that is the end of part one. Join us again in part two, where Mark and Tim will discuss with Kickley all about how he rediscovered G.I. Joe toys, the artwork of Hector Garrido, how he goes about creating his G.I. Joe paintings, a super commission that he did for a big fan, and more on his G.I. Joe work besides. See you then. I made this.